Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's 26th of July, 2023, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index, here to talk about some of the comings and goings in the UK construction industry over the past couple of weeks. Apart from everything getting extremely wet, Phil, have you noticed anything interesting happening?
Blimey, O'Reilly, it's supposed to be the silly season and nothing happening. It's the summer and Parliament's on holiday and, you know, there's not supposed to be any news, but there's absolutely been masses going on in the past fortnight. Most of it, as we'll come on to talk about, involving Michael Gove one way or another.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to chew over. How about yourself? What's caught your eye this week?
Well, much the same as Michael Gove is a gift that keeps on goving. I've never been a Gove fan. I've always found him rather irritating and a bit suspect, especially when he was the education secretary many years ago. But I was having a conversation with my wife recently after listening to him on the radio saying, do you know what? I think he's one of the few serious politicians left in Westminster at the moment. Everybody else seems to be either going mad or spouting platitudes. And Michael Gove, like him or not, actually sounds a bit like a statesman. And I never thought I'd say that.
No, I've got to say, I agree with you. They talk about there not being many grown-ups left in the room. I'd like to say it's because of an old, you know, an old journalist, of course, but then so was Boris Johnson, and that didn't do us any good.
Yeah.
No, Gove, he upsets people and makes waves, but boy, is he busy. I mean, he's busy in doing things, and he's a one-man government machine, government machine on his own.
Yeah. He doesn't seem to be easily distracted from the job in hand. I mean, somebody from particularly the Labour Party this morning on the radio, he was a shadow secretary for, I can't remember what it was, but he wasn't a big name, but he seemed to be floundering when asked about things which were outside of his remit. And we're talking about one or two of these sort of issues that the Labour government, I think, seems to be floundering amongst at the moment, which is things like, you know, the social justice issues, which I think the Labour Party can't quite get its story right on. And I don't know, that's not the sort of thing that Gove seems to worry about. He just cracks on with the job in hand, and I suppose I respect him for that.
But it helps that by all accounts he knows how to unwind and relax as well, which is always a secret. The secret of productivity is taking time out every now and then to do what you have to do to relax.
What does he do? What does Gove do to relax?
There's pictures of him enjoying himself in nightclubs and things.
All right, yeah, okay. I suppose we ought to talk about one or two of the industry topics.
Let's set the context before we move on to talk about all that's been happening in the world of politics. We're a year out from a general election, give or take, maybe 18 months. Maybe less than a year. And we just had these three on the same day, these three by-elections, which was broadly 1-1 for the three main parties, but seems to broadly but not wholeheartedly confirm the consensus that Labour are going to get an overall majority narrowly at the next election.
Yeah.
But not only is there that landscape, there's the economy, of course, going on. And this week we had the latest quarterly forecasts for the construction industry from the Construction Products Association. And these quarterly forecasts that the Construction Products Association put out are fairly highly regarded in the industry. They're considered as among the best indicators of what's going on, even though they're not actually right terribly often, as we'll come on to see. But they do set the mood, and the Construction Products Association came out this week with summer forecasts saying that UK construction output would fall by 7% this year and growing by just 0.7% next year.
Hmm.
Now, a year ago, the CPA was saying that we'd be growing 1.6% this year and 2.5% in next year in 2024. So between August 2022 and August 2023, they've completely done a reverse ferret. But
yeah,
of course, that's not just because their economists are useless. It's because their economists are not superhuman. They never are. They didn't know that what Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng were going to do in that notorious budget last September. And they didn't know that Putin was going to invade Ukraine and energy prices across the world were going to go haywire. You know, as I said in the post edit online, there are two economic shocks that no one had or could have predicted.
Hmm.
However, there are always things like that. There are always events. So economists can only ever set down forecasts with a whole host of assumptions, which are rarely safe to assume. So that said, I mean, even if you just go back 3 months ago, let's see, what was the CPA was saying? They were saying in May, they were saying that the output this year would decline by 6.4%. And now they're going, it's going to be even worse. So between May and August, July, I beg your pardon. We're not in August yet, are we? I'm moving myself forward.
No, not quite.
but in the past 3 months, things have got marginally even worse for the UK construction industry this year. So it's all pretty gloomy. And most of that is based on the house building. We know that mortgage interest rates have gone up hugely, and that's impacting on demand for private housing. Well, not demand, but affordability. Everyone wants a house, but no one can afford it.
Yes, of course.
But more than that, the repair and maintenance, or repair, maintenance and improvement, the RMI market, which had a little bit of a boom in the COVID lockdown period as everyone was, you know, converting a spare bedroom to an office or putting an office up in the garden and doing up their houses and gardens because there's nothing else to do.
Nothing else to do, yeah.
That's all tapered off because no one's got any spare cash anymore. But the RMI output in private housing is forecast, CPA say, to fall by 11% this year before growing back 2% next year. So that it's not, you know, it's all bits of the private house building market, the repair and maintenance and the new build market are clobbered. Infrastructure, they're saying, thanks to HS2, Thames Tideway, Hinkley Point C, they're all, you know, going along and doing okay. But even they aren't great. They're saying infrastructure output will fall 0.5% this year before growth of 1% next year, which is all pretty grim. It doesn't look like the construction industry is going to save the government or save the economy in time for the Conservatives to win the next election.
No, quite.
Unless the man in charge of, you know, planning and broader speaking, construction, overseeing the economic activity that construction industry generates to the economy, unless he can pull lots and lots of rabbits out of hats.
Yeah, I suppose the problem is it's in the nature of the beast that a forecast is based on the prevailing conditions at the time, and you try and extrapolate those and see which way they're going. It's not an accurate, it's not an exact science, is it? So there's a lot of guesswork involved. But you're quite right. The fact is that there's been a steady and sort of inexorable revision of the forecast throughout the past 12 months, and it's all gone one way, which is downhill. So I suppose you could say that the CPA's forecast trend is probably reliable because they're reviewing the circumstances all the time, and it does look as if things are getting worse. But when you reported this, when did you report this?
Was it just on Monday this week?
It was just on Monday. I noticed that right at the end, you pointed out that actually there might be a glimmer of hope because not everybody is quite as gloomy as the CPA. For the Purchasing Managers Index was, not exactly wildly optimistic, but it certainly wasn't as gloomy, was it?
No, I can't remember. I said what it's been averaging this year, which is 50.9, just above the 50, no growth. Let's just have a look at what the latest one. And of course, the PMI, the Purchasing Managers Index, is a survey that looks backwards rather than forward. So it's
that's true. Yes,
it's more qualitative than quantitative. Although I think even the ONS statistics of output are qualitative rather than quantitative. I'm dubious of all statistics because I know where they're getting the numbers from, and I know how these things work. And they rely on people to fill in forms they don't really want to be filling in.
Yes, exactly. In fact, we did have a guest recently on the podcast from the ONS who explained. I thought it was very interesting. He revealed or explained to us how the ONS gathers its information and what it does with it. And this is going off on a bit of a tangent, but I had personal experience of that over the last couple of weeks, because I was contacted by the ONS, not in my capacity as a construction journalist, but in my capacity as an ordinary householder.
Nothing ordinary about you, David. Don't believe them.
But you know, they produce sort of retail index, and you know, various consumer indexes, as well as obviously the construction ones. And they said that I had been selected, or rather, my household had been selected, to provide basic information about our expenditure, so that they could gather, that they could compile the latest figures for the. I think it was a retail prices index. I assume it was, and it was fine. But it was very different from the methods that they used to gather the construction information. If you remember, people are selected at random in the construction industry, businesses, well, not rather than people, to provide input to the statistics, and they are actually required by law to provide this information, whereas private householders are not compelled to do so. They're bribed. We're paid £50 to provide the ONS with our information,
But even then, how good is the information you give? I mean, if the ONS came to me and said, "How much did you spend on groceries in the past month?" I wouldn't go to my you know, bank statements and look it all up. I'd just go, "Oh, I don't know, probably yeah."
No, it's not like that, Phil.
200 quid, maybe, including booze?
It's not like that, Phil. You keep every single receipt and you make a note of everything you spend. So that's what I did for 2 weeks. It was like doing my expenses back in the olden days and trying not to fiddle them.
I don't think everyone would be as diligent as you, though. I think they'd just go, probably about that. That'll put that down.
That is absolutely true, because at the moment, my youngest daughter is back from university, and we said to her, you know, you are included in this because you're part of the household. So everything you spend, keep the receipt. And she came back having filled up her car with petrol, and we said, "Receipt, please." And she said, "Oh, I didn't get one." So we had to just make a note of that. Well, yeah, obviously, it's not an exact science, as I said before, and people forget to keep a note of these things and to keep every single receipt. Yeah, it's a bit of a wet finger in the wind, I think, that you hope that the majority of people provide you with relatively accurate information, and from that you can compile an overall picture, a snapshot. And that's what the ONS does, and that's what the ONS construction output figures are based on.
But going back to the PMI, the Purchasing Managers Index there, which we're talking about, I've just pulled up the latest one, which is for June. We will get the July one in about 10 days' time or so. And June was 48.9, which is below the 50. Which means it's going down.
Yes.
Negative growth, down from 51.6 in May. So while the first 6 months of the year have overall been above 50 marginally and narrowly, the current direction of travel is down. And I suppose if the CPA are right, as I said in the piece that I did on Monday, if the CPA are right, we will see the PMI that comes out at the beginning of August for July
fall even further.
Maybe not further, but still in negative country.
Still negative.
Still below
50. Yeah, okay. Oh, well, that's very depressing then, Phil. I know we've had a difficult year, there's no doubt about it. And in fact, I had a meeting with my private financial advisor only last week. He showed me a very worrying graph, which showed a very sharp drop in the value of my investments during Liz Truss's brief tenureship of number 10. Yeah, it has recovered, I'm pleased to say, but it was, for me, a personal indication of the damage done by that brief interlude. And I think, I mean, at the time, I thought it was scary that something so drastic and short-lived could happen in British politics. But I think maybe we're going to see more of this sort of thing happening. We don't have, you know, we were talking at the beginning of this podcast about how there don't seem to be that many grown-ups in Westminster at the moment. I don't know whether that's simply because you and I are getting so old, but it all seems a bit flaky and a bit worrying. So, yes, with these figures and forecasts showing a likely decline in our prosperity, it's all a bit worrying.
Well, these things come and go. You have to take the long picture. In, you know, in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, over time, you know, graphs go up and down and investments go up and down.
Sure.
But yes, we can afford we ought to, in our savings, take a longer-term view. For a government facing an election in, as I say, 12 months, give or take, it cannot afford to take a look. It needs rapid action. That's the economic context behind our next topic.
Which is?
Which is the Governator. Michael Gove. Or the Governator.
Quite a lot to say this week.
Yes, he gave this speech. I can't recall where he was. It might have been Newcastle. Anyway, setting out a raft of policies, some mostly restatements of things that have been said before, a bit of fleshing out, and some actual new things which might not save the economy particularly, but are significant to the construction industry.
Yes.
And he encompassed some of the things that his predecessor had been talking about making beautiful places and beautiful buildings. Yeah. He talked about speeding up planning, fast-tracking planning. He talked about kickstarting house building, hit squads of planners, all sorts of things, giving communities back control, making sure housing is warm and decent, some post-Grenfell stuff, messes. But let's just pick out some of the key measures. One of them is on the subject of planning, further relaxation of permitted development rights. This is the making or allowing property owners to build extensions
and stuff,
build up, build out, and to convert shops, close down shops into homes or offices into homes, but it's normally shops these days. Now, we've already had this. It's just a further movement in the direction of travel. They've already relaxed permitted development rights, and they're consulting on relaxing them further. And another thing he's talking about is compensation in compulsory purchase orders, which, remember, Keir Starmer talked about hope value premium is going to be abolished when he becomes prime minister, he said. And Gove was saying that basically the amount that landowners get for selling agricultural land, government don't want to pay quite as much. They want to get it more cheaply. So they're going to take a cut of the, I mean, as soon as land gets planning permission, of course, its value goes up.
Value goes right up, yeah.
And what the quote says, he wants landowners to receive fair compensation for their land while minimising the public sector investment required to bring the development forward. I mean, this is not particularly new, but one thing that is very new on the Grenfell subject is that all residential buildings over 18 metres will have to have a second staircase. Mm. Now, the government a few months ago came out and said, or was it last year, but it came out and said that we're going to make a second staircase compulsory in all buildings over 30 metres. Mm. And a coalition of construction industry professionals came out and said, well, actually, you know, 30 metres is pretty high. I think 18 metres. I mean, the context of this is that if your tower block's on fire and you can't use the lifts, you need one set of stairs for people to escape and another set of stairs for the fire brigade to get in, effectively. And he's listened to the industry lobbying and he said, yep, 18 metres it is then. So that's the new plan. I don't know when that's actually going to take effect. But where he's being reasonable We talked about him, you know, being pragmatic.
Yes.
Is that he doesn't want all these schemes, because we've already had schemes that have been sent back to the drawing board, because they've, you know, buildings in preparation, in planning, with only one set of staircase, suddenly, oh, we can't build that now. And several major construction projects have stalled because they've fallen foul of this sudden two staircase rule.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's sort of saying, well, he actually doesn't want to see anything in the works stop or stall. I mean, you know, an element of flexibility will work with you on this. And, you know, so it might be that there's a longer lead-in period for this. So there's pragmatism there. One of the things in talking of pragmatism I thought was particularly interesting, just today, and I'm talking on, we're talking on Wednesday, he's published a consultation paper on reforms to the consenting process for nationally significant infrastructure projects. These are the things that need a development consent order, big power stations, motorways and the like. And they go to the planning inspectorate rather than to, you know, your local borough council. They go to the National Planning Inspectorate for approval. They spend months chewing it over. Then they send their report to the Secretary of State, who spends months chewing it over. The Secretary of State probably loses their job and a new person comes in. And then they spend a few more months chewing it over. And these things just take bloody forever. And he thinks, well, there must be ways to speed it up. And one of the things he's suggesting, which I think is cute, but could get into trouble. It's a tough one to call. You know how the Health and Safety Executive has two functions. It polices health and safety on in workplaces. I was going to say construction sites, wider than that. It polices health and safety, but it's also the health and safety consultant to a lesser extent these days, but it used to provide a lot of consultancy services to industry, to say, these are the rules. We want you to comply. We're going to show you, we're going to help you to comply, and we'll hold your hand and guide you to compliance rather than stand back, wait for you to screw up and fine you.
Yeah.
And similarly, it seems to me, having a quick read this morning of this consultation paper, Gove's idea is that the planning inspectorate, instead of just being a policeman that stands back, waits to receive your application and goes, nah, that's rubbish, and chucks it back, like it did to National Highways when it had its application for Lower Thames Crossing thrown its face. And it took another year before National Highways got its paperwork for Lower Thames Crossing back in order to resubmit. The planning inspectorate will, under this suggestion, get, I would say, in bed with the developer or the promoter of the project, but will certainly sit alongside their bed as a nursemaid or a doctor and hold their hand and help them and advise them while they're drawing up their application to make sure the application is tidy down the line in preparation, which sounds sensible to me, except when something then gets turned down by the planning inspectorate, the organisation that's put in the application go, hang on a minute, you told us to do this.
Yeah. it puts the planning inspectorate in a difficult position, doesn't it? I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I hadn't read that story. I didn't know about this. But on my first sort of reaction to it is that, yes, that does make sense, because, you know, rather than leaving somebody in the dark and just hoping that, you know, leaving them to hope that they're doing the right thing, giving somebody a hint, you know, I wouldn't do that if I were you, or why don't you consider something else, sounds plausible. But to then turn around and say, no, that's not good enough, would be a bit of a slap in the face. But then, unless you're actually writing their essays for them, doing their homework for them, then they're still, basically, it's still up to them to put forward their case. So I think it's how it's handled is the crucial thing. If they're still going to be the policeman as well as the tutor, if you like, I suppose, or the advisor, then they have to stand back and maybe just raise a warning signal when they can see that whoever the developer is, whatever the developer is trying to do, is going in the wrong direction. Let them know that before they waste everybody's time and go off in the wrong direction and ultimately fail. So I can see the logic.
Yes, I can. Ultimately, of course, it will still remain up to the relevant Secretary of State to say yay or nay at the end of the day. The planning inspectorate is merely advisory, but previously it's only advised the Secretary of State. Now it's advising, or the proposal is, it will advise the applicants as well during the application process. So that's that was quite an interesting idea.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, obviously, I suppose that if you look at the bottom line, it will save time and money for everybody concerned. It should do anyway. So there's a lot to be said for that. As long as it's not, as you say, if they were to literally jump in bed, metaphorically jump in bed with the developer and say, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, you know, this will get past the Secretary of State, so, you know, why don't you do this? That would be wrong. But it doesn't have to be like that.
Another area of Gove's recent speech was in to do with development corporations, and all governments are in this quandary or bind, Morton's fork, of they want to build loads, but they don't want to build. They don't, you know, Sunak said, Prime Minister said, we're not going to concrete over the Greenbelt. We're going to focus on brownfield and urban areas. And they're always trying to square the circle because the two conflicting audiences, there's the existing homeowner and there's the wannabe homeowner. Now, the wannabe homeowner wants houses to be built everywhere so that the prices come down and they can afford to buy a house and live somewhere nice. The people who are already living somewhere nice don't want that because it's more cars on the road and lack of infrastructure. And
spoils their little bit of, you know, our green and pleasant land, doesn't it?
Yes, so exactly.
Of course, they don't want people moving in.
All governments have to square that knotty circle.
Yeah, that's true.
But what Gove's talking about is development corporations. He invokes the name of Heseltine, although just to keep all sides of the party on side, he used the term Thatcher and the Heseltines Urban Development, London Docklands Development Corporation.
Yes, yeah.
And he's talking about expanding the development corporation concept beyond the boundaries of the current London Docklands area to bits of East London, North Kent, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
We've heard this before. I mean, the whole Thames Estuary development was supposed to be, well, it is happening, but very slowly, the development of Thames Estuary house building there. So again, nothing particularly new there, but it's a lot of boosterism there, to use a Johnsonism.
Should we move on to what else Gove said?
Okay, I know where you're going. You're going shopping.
I'd like to go shopping, but it depends where. Apparently, it's not a good idea to go shopping on Oxford Street in London anymore because there aren't any shops.
Unless you've got horrible little sweeties from American.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, I imagine all the shops are going to be turned into flats anyway. So, this is a lovely story. I say it's a lovely story. It's Gove again.
Not if the chief executive of Marks and Spencer's, it's not.
Well, no, certainly not. Gove really threw a cat amongst the pigeons because Marks and Spencer, you know, probably our favorite, after John Lewis, probably our favorite retailer, or is that Tesco? I don't know. Anyway, you know, everybody knows who Marks and Spencer is. Their flagship store on Oxford Street is an old building. It's been refused listing status twice, apparently, and I hadn't realized this. I don't know. I mean, I can see a photograph of it. I'm looking at a photograph of it on my screen. It looks sort of like rather a nice building, probably 1920s or 30s, with a very prominent position on a corner of Oxford Street, and I don't know what the other street is. Anyway, this is Marks & Spencer's flagship store. I think it's actually empty at the moment. They want to knock it down and build a new flagship store on the site. That's basically what it is. And they've got great plans for this, Marks & Spencer. They want to build a real landmark building, which will be extremely green and probably carbon negative. I don't know exactly what the energy profile of it's going to be, but it's going to be cutting edge anyway. And Michael Gove said, no, you can't. You can't knock down that old building. You haven't made the case against retrofitting it. Now, of course, retrofitting, we talked about this just the other week. Energy retrofitting is one of the hot topics at the moment because we've got a very old housing stock in this country. Particularly applies to housing, but not exclusively to housing. And a lot of people are pushing for money in government investment into retrofitting. In other words, retrofitting these old buildings with energy-saving technologies, with insulation and renewable energy and heat pumps and triple glazing, all the rest of it, to bring these old energy-inefficient buildings up to modern standards. And Gove is saying that Marks and Spencer's has failed to look into the options for retrofitting this building and making it into an acceptable energy efficient retail outlet again. Anyway, it's difficult to know which side of the argument I side with here, because on the one hand, I can perfectly appreciate that Marks and Spencer's wants to make a statement here. After all, it's their flagship store and it's about their profile, and they want to be showing people that, you know, modern retailers are with it, and, you know, are sort of bought into net zero and all the rest of it. But on the other hand, Michael Gove saying no, we, you know, that knocking this down and building a new building out of presumably new materials is not an energy efficient way to go, and it doesn't matter how energy efficient the new building is, it would be a much better use of existing resources to retrofit the old building. And the chief executive, I think it's the chief executive of Marks and Spencer, is absolutely spitting bullets about this. He's absolutely mad. Stuart Machin, yes, chief executive, who said that, yeah, our investment in 2,000 jobs, building one of the most sustainable buildings in London, improving the public realm and creating a flagship store, is now effectively in the deep freeze. And that's just part of what he said. He said an awful lot more about it as well. What's your opinion, Phil? Do you think, are you with Machin or are you with Gove?
I think I'm handing Gove.
Yeah, I think I do. I mean,
if M&S want to make some architectural grand statement of how big their whatever is, let them go do it in Milton Keynes. Yeah. Oxford Street has a certain look, I'm not entirely with Prince Charles preserve everything in aspic, but I'm fed up of these gherkins and walkie-talkies and architectural statement buildings, which add nothing to the look and feel of the capital city. Occasionally they do, but on the whole they don't. And I'm not saying that the artist's impressions, the architect impressions of the new M&S is quite as bad as the gherkin, but it does look like a university building.
Have you seen the artist impressions?
Yes.
Because I haven't seen
it. There's one on our site, on the Construction Index site, on the
oh, is there? Oh, dear.
If you scroll halfway down, you can click on it and enlarge it.
Oh, I can see it, yeah. Only a little picture, but yes, I've...
It looks like, Department for Engineering at the University of New Hereford or somewhere.
That's true. It does. It's completely inoffensive and it's probably lovely inside, but yeah, I think it's architecturally quite bland. It's got a green roof by the looks of it, or a garden.
But I'd rather it be architecturally bland than architecturally cool. Blimey, look at this, love me or hate me. Visually, the existing Oxford Street building, Marble Arch it is actually.
It needs Marble Arch, okay, yeah.
Just needs a bit of a scrub.
Yes, I think I'm with you on that. Going back, you mentioned in passing, you mentioned the gherkin, or is it 30 St Mary Axe? I can't remember what the actual name is. I'd love to know how energy efficient that building is, because it's been there for how long now? Must be about 15, 20 years?
At least 20, I'd say, yeah.
I wonder what its energy profile is. I wonder how carbon efficient it is, because...
It's glass heavy, isn't it?
Well, it is very glass heavy. It was built at a time when, really, it was one of the first of the... of this crop of massive tower blocks in the City of London, many of which have sprung up since then. And really, the carbon agenda really wasn't fully underway then, was it? It wasn't quite as pressing a concern as it is now. And yet we've had this incredible growth of glass-clad buildings, tower blocks, in the City of London since then. I'd be interested to see how energy efficient they are, each of them. I mean, the walkie-talkie and the cheese grater and all the other ones, you know, with a silly name. Were they worth building in the first place? From the planet's point of view, if anybody else is, I don't know. But I agree. I I do think that retrofitting is a good idea, and if somebody paid me money to retrofit my house, I'd bite their hand off. But I agree with you. Rather than knocking an old building down, see if you can preserve it and improve it rather than get rid of it altogether.
And going back to statement building, I don't know what it's called, but the building that used to be the Mayor of London's official office block, it's another sort of round thing near the on the South Bank, near Tower Bridge, I think, between Tower Bridge and the Eye, anyway. That, I mean, Sadiq Khan's moved out of that, and he's moved east into Newham or somewhere, rather than being in central London.
Really?
I don't know whether that's got any occupants at the moment, but another landmark building built for the Mayor of London, the Mayor of London goes, nah, don't want it.
Really? Now that's it. I hadn't realised. That passed me by. Well, I never.
That's a while ago. That was a while ago. Couldn't tell you when. But you mentioned the energy performance of buildings. Going back to Michael Gove, another thing he's been in the news. He was on the Today programme yesterday morning discussing the whole, you know, net zero thing. And this is a whole other can of worms.
Yes.
In the wake of the by-election losses last week, a lot of the Tory right and the Telegraph and the Mail are saying things. It's time to abandon the net zero deadlines. Mm. Got to soften on the net zero deadlines. And while Gav, I believe he said that the no internal combustion engine cars passed, or new ones passed 2030, that deadline's, he thinks, stays, although Sunak is being a bit non-committal on it. He did say that the requirement for energy performance, the minimum standards for EPC, energy performance certificates, which are due to come in 2025, he said, we're going to move away from the strict deadline that we have at the moment. Quote, I want to signal to the people in the private rented sector that we've heard their concerns at this point. Mm. Again, this is another very tight net zero related deadline that governments have kept cranking up. And Boris Johnson was a great one, saying, I'm the guest, I'm the most this and I'm the most that. And I'm going to go even further than the last person. I'm going to do even better than the last person. And setting these tight deadlines, and chickens have come home to roost. And actually these deadlines, it's great that we're working really, really hard to get to them, but there's an awful lot of fallout for an awful lot of people. And now that these things are getting closer and the pain is becoming more apparent, you know, the Just Stop Oil protesters notwithstanding, and other opponents of, let me say, freedom fighters for the planet.
Okay, yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
There are a lot of people who are financially suffering, in the drive towards net zero.
Yeah.
And the signs that the government is listening to that. And I think that the next election, general election, net zero will become, in the context of the by-elections in Uxbridge, it was all about the ultra low emission zone extension, which we've discussed before. But it's wider than that. It's wider than cars. The fact that, you know, you might not be able to sell your house. I think Scotland are talking about, you'll have to have a heat pump if you want to sell your house.
Really?
In not very many years' time. I mean, there's an awful lot of net zero fascism going on here.
Yeah.
And there's kickback, there's political kickback. And this is going to leave the construction industry in the quandary, because construction industry likes the certainty. If they know that absolutely that how many thousands of heat pumps will be installed in the next whatever, 5 years,
they can
years,
start tooling
years.
Up.
They tool up, they gear up, they train up. And if they do all that and the government says, oh, no, we've changed our minds, then that's an awful lot of waste that the construction industry has to foot the bill for.
Yeah.
So from a purely business point of view, disregarding morals, ethics, the planet, the future of mankind and everything else, from a purely financial point of view, I suspect the construction industry doesn't really care what government policy is. It just wants to know what it is.
Yeah.
And for government to stick with it. It wants certainty, continuity, and say, okay, this is what we're doing. If you're going to build no more roads, you're only going to build, you know, cycle lanes and whatever, then okay, that's the market. Mm. That's what we'll do. We'll get rid of our wide pavers and we'll just buy narrow pavers. We can do that.
But I think getting any certainty, particularly on the sort of carbon, you know, the net zero target is very difficult, because we set this legally binding, or I don't know who's going to go to prison if we break it, the legally binding target of net zero by 2050. without actually a detailed plan of how we're going to get there. We're sort of looking for ways across. We can see the destination, and we've got to hack our way through the forest in order to get there. But we don't know what route we're going to take and what we're going to have to do in order to get there. So it's very scary. There's no certainty about, you know, what's going to happen. Maybe in 2048, the government of the time is going to do something really drastic because it realizes it's only got 2 years to go. And of course, that'll scare everybody.
Your analogy is absolutely right. But on the flip side of that, the destination is across a great big forest, and we don't know the route. But if we determine the route in advance for something, you know, 30 or even 10 years hence, it might prove to be completely the most stupid route going, because this technological while we're traveling, things change. You know, you're going around with your machete, and suddenly someone invents a chainsaw, and you can cut through a lot quicker. So it's not just that we don't know the route, we don't know what tools we'll have at our disposal as we get nearer to the destination.
Yes, maybe the problem is the destination itself. Maybe by fixing an arbitrary deadline of 2050, we've made a rod for our own backs, and it'll have to. I mean, people are talking about, as you said, a lot of people, particularly on the Tory right, are saying that we ought to reconsider these targets because they're not reasonable, they're not viable.
Do you think it would have been better from the outset, and it's not too late to change, instead of saying net zero by a certain date, we should have said we will reduce our carbon fuel consumption by X percent a year, and, you know, we can revisit every year where it's best reduced. But if there's a commitment to reduce reduce the carbon footprint every year, just to improve, continuous improvement, the good old Japanese way of thinking, if we just get better every year, might not that be good enough?
Or is it too late? I think that would be better. But I think the language of net zero makes that very difficult. That case very difficult to make, because we talk in terms of climate emergency, and that simply let's try and reduce it bit by bit without an end in sight isn't good enough. Only this week, I think on Monday, it might have even been yesterday, I heard climate scientists talking about this on the radio, saying, you know, our aim is to get, 1.5% of 1990, I can't remember even what the 1.5 represents. But, you know, there's this campaign to keep 1.5 alive. And now the climate scientists are saying, we'll be lucky if we get 2.5. And we set these, it's like a religious mantra that this figure sort of takes on almost mythical significance, that you have to reach this 1.5 target, otherwise the planet's going to burn up and everybody's going to drown and all the rest of it. And I think that perhaps there's not enough pragmatism and too much, I don't know, grasping at figures, too much oversimplification perhaps, in terms of telling people what we ought to be aiming for and not explaining the issues surrounding it, how we ought to get there, and if we can get there, and if not, what our plan B might be.
Doesn't sound like you're going to be gluing your hand to any statues in the near future, David.
I don't know. I mean, I do worry about global warming. I think the evidence is too strong to take a climate denial approach. But I think maybe the way we're approaching it isn't the correct way. And of course, that's a classic example of criticizing something without offering an alternative. And I'm afraid I can't. I just don't feel comfortable with the way we are approaching the problem. And I don't honestly know. I think what you've just suggested perhaps is better, to do it by increments. But I know a lot of people would say, no, it's not enough. We have to be absolute about this. And we have to set these deadlines, and we have to do everything we can to achieve them. Otherwise, we're going to be in big, big trouble, which I think we will be anyway. And I don't think we're going to reach the 2050 target either. I said that before, and I still think it's true.
Well, let's see what the manifestos say next year, because I think that's going to be the interesting one.
Yeah. So, talking about people in trouble, Phil, is it time to move on to our third and final topic of the podcast?
Yeah, yes, let's move away from government to governance.
Aha, okay.
We've talked before about turmoil at Inland Homes. Inland Homes is a housing developer that focuses largely on the southeast and south of England, redeveloping brownfield sites. It's stock market AIM, alternative investment market, stock market listed.
Mm-hmm.
Founded, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, something like that.
Yeah.
2005 it founded. And we've discussed and reported on the Construction Index. End of last year, the founder and chief executive of the company retired. He moved on, and a new chap came in. And the new chap was gone within about 5 weeks. And a few weeks after that, profits warning, the entire board resigns, apart from the finance director, who's also another of the founding shareholders. And he's left as de facto interim chief executive. They bring in someone else to be a non-executive chairman from outside. And these two people have been trying to right the ship and sort things out.
Yeah.
All that was said at the time of this profits warning and everything was there were some question marks about what are called related party transactions, which is, to me, meaningless jargon, but apparently it meant the auditors couldn't sign off their accounts. They were late filing their accounts, and therefore their trading of Inland Home shares on the AIM market was suspended, and they've still been trying to sort it out. They brought in forensic accountants from FRP to explore what was going on with these related party transactions and what all that was about. And pending the findings of that, they would hope to get their last year's accounts published in the fullness of time and get back on listed on the market again, or their shares trading on the market again, and get the business going forward again.
Yeah.
That's all background. What's happened this week? On Monday this week, first of all, 7 o'clock in the morning, they've announced that they found a new chief executive who's going to come in and rescue the business. And this guy, interesting chap, Jolyon Harrison, 75-year-old former Gleeson chief executive. He left Gleeson, I think, 3 years ago when he was 72, roughly speaking, suddenly, let's put it that way. Okay. The board, I think, were quite keen to sort of press him as to say, look, you're 72, old chap, you've done a fantastic job, but, you know, time to move on.
Yeah.
And the way it was portrayed, it seemed to be kind of, he was not ready to go. He said, I've got plenty of time left in me. And they said there were negotiations over terms and timing of his departure broke down. Failure to reach agreement on the terms and timing of departure. So he went with no kind of, normally when people, chief executives go, it's they're going to leave next year or they're going to leave
yes.
6 months.
But yes.
This went. So clearly Jolyon Harrison has got, you know, life in the old dog left. He's come back at the age of 75. Not only is he chief executive of Inland Homes, as part of the new arrangements, Inland Homes is buying his business for £4 million, his business, North Country Homes. And North Country Homes is becoming part of Inland Homes. As its name implies, North Country Homes is based in the north of England, South Yorkshire, I think.
Hang on a second, Phil. North Country Homes is owned by Jolyon Harrison, is it?
Correct.
Right, okay.
And others. He owns 51% of North Country Homes.
Yeah.
And he's got a mate who owns the other 49% or so, or 40-something percent. And the other guy is going to become a non-executive director of Inland Homes. So these two people from North Country Homes are effectively now running Inland Homes. The old finance director, interim CEO, he's going. He's retiring after a suitable handover period. So the former Gleeson chap, 75-year-old Jolyon Harrison, and his mate from North Country Homes are now going to run Inland Homes. They're going to finish off the build, the development that Inland Homes have got in the south of it, southeast of England. But they're going to shift their focus to the north of England.
Okay.
Basically, a shadow of what Gleeson does, building low-cost, affordable housing under the, I don't know what the brand will be, Inland or North Country, but they're moving. They're not moving the office north yet, or at this stage, and they plan to move the office north. But the focus of the operations will be moved from the south southeast to the north of England. So this is all interesting. This is the turnaround plan.
What about jobs? Is he making anybody redundant, or is he going to keep everybody on?
There's no suggestion of that. I think most of the pain has been done already. I don't think they have much of a direct building workforce.
Okay.
They're going to keep on doing the developments they're doing southeast. And I think the aspiration from everything here would be for growth. There might be, I don't think North Country Homes has got masses of employees. There might be someone in financial control is no longer required, but I don't even think that's going to be the case. I don't think that's the story as I see it anyway.
Right, okay.
Forgive me if I'm wrong, for anyone who has lost their job under this acquisition. But anyway, later on that same day, or perhaps the next day it was, later on the same day, the Inland Homes new board released the FRP report, the report by the forensic accountants, into these related party transactions. And what it turns out that was going on at Inland Homes under the founding shareholders, Stephen Wicks is the former CEO and Nish Maldi, the finance guy, is it sounds like, well, what the report says is that they had been doing things in breach of AIM trading rules.
Yeah.
Because Stephen Wicks and Nish Maldi, as well as having shares in Inland Homes, they also had a business which they co-owned 40% each called First Place Nurseries Limited. This is nurseries as in primary, pre-primary schools,
yes.
Not as in garden centres.
Yeah, okay.
And
which would perhaps have been a little bit more understandable, but preschool nurseries and house building, I suppose there's a link.
Well, no, Inland Homes does these placemaking, is it,
yeah.
Thing?
Yeah, yeah.
Where you need to put in schools and doctor surgeries,
sure.
And so on.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was one particular development site of Inland Homes, a big one, Wilton Park in Beaconsfield area, where First Place Nurseries, FPN, which is a related party, this is a related party,
yes.
It's a related,
yes.
Party to Inland Homes. Inland Homes gave FPN leased to buildings on its development site to run the school. It seems like FPN wasn't paying as much as it might have been, or at least no, the Inland Homes shareholders were not given the opportunity to scrutinise the deal because it wasn't reported in the way that it was supposed to have been reported. And there were other things going on. There were properties leased to members of the Wicks family, financial transactions and relations between Inland and First Place Nurseries that had not been disclosed,
right.
To the board of Inland Homes, which reminds me somewhat of a chap I used to be vaguely acquainted with, encountered him on the hockey pitch in the olden days, called Greg Hutchins, who was ex-Hansen type, son of Hansen, not literally, and I can't remember his vehicle, but he built up a now it would be called private equity, basically built up an empire, which was famously described as the guns to buns empire, because he owned Smith & Wesson and Rankovis McDougall.
Right, okay.
So it's quite a diverse conglomerate in the way that Hansen built up all sorts of things and became the, you know, the company from over here that's doing rather well over there.
That's right. And that was their slogan. Yeah.
Greg Hutchins was terribly successful, terribly wealthy, one man human dynamo. But while being this person, he wasn't Jim Ratcliffe or Dyson, who own their own company and therefore can buy a helicopter with the company money and go to, you know, Monaco with the with their company private helicopter. His company was stock market listed, and therefore he wasn't allowed to behave in the way that Jim Ratcliffe or James Dyson can operate, or Lord Bamford. I mean, Lord Bamford could do things which, for example, the directors of Inland Homes can't do
because, no. Yeah,
because of city rules.
Yeah.
So this is not to suggest that there was any sort of, you know, anything wrong with what they're doing other than breach of the rules. So that has all now come out. A very long report
that the Director of Inland Homes put out, and they're now working their way through, and they've written new rules or new boardroom rules at Inland Homes to make sure that this can't happen again.
Right.
I mean, Jolyon Harrison's now a 4.5% shareholder of Inland Homes. The Inland Homes have made sure that these infractions will not be repeated.
Yeah. Right, interesting. It was interesting, Saga.
My dog is shouting at me, David.
Okay, all right then. Does that mean we've got to go?
We do. He's making a right old racket. so yeah, we need to wrap it up.
Okay.
How many of these podcasts have we done now? This is episode 132. Good Lord.
Is it really?
Right. So we'll be back again for episode 133 in August. Thank you to everyone once again for joining us. And unless David's got anything to add, I'm going to say goodbye. David, do you want to say goodbye?
I'll say goodbye, but I haven't got nothing to add to that. Until next time.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.